You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 5th of January, 2022. There are rumors floating around the internet that I am getting remarried, and those rumors are true. Thank God for economy, as far as the canons are concerned. Really based on the notion that I didn't initiate the previous divorce in 2014, which was so bad that it kept me off the air for a while. Jennifer and I got COVID together, and even in dire pain and suffering, she made sure I had everything I needed. I'm as red pill as they come. I know what to look for, and I am absolutely certain that this is the right thing. I'm extremely happy for the first time in a very long time. And it's a bit more common, especially in Eastern Europe, than you think. Second marriages are always an issue, but what a modern woman can do in initiating divorce and destroying a man simply was not possible at the time, in the ancient world. So it is one of the most extraordinary aspects of my life, just, when I turn 50. And I know exactly what I have. And I'm very, very impressed. And I'm not easily impressed. I don't like many people, let alone love anyone. But the cat was kind of out of the bag in my latest book, In the Middle Ages, where I dedicated it to her in very romantic terms. So there's absolutely no question as to what's going on here. So, that being said, and we're getting married this year, I want to talk about a topic that has no relation to that. I actually was thinking about talking about the red pill, which I have never talked about on here before. After my divorce in 2014, I read all three volumes of Rollo Tomassi's The Rational Male in one sitting. In one sitting. It changed my life. I don't believe in everything they stand for. There's a lot of problems in the theory, but it can clarify a lot of things for a lot of guys, and I strongly recommend at least the first volume of that book. Rather, I want to talk about, and this may come as another shock to you, another surprise, on a podcast called The Orthodox Nationalist, I want to talk about Orthodox nationalism, specifically the Orthodox view of the state. And in my career, I've gone from statist to anti-statist. Royalism is not really based on a tightly centralized strong state. Usually aristocratic families rather than bureaucracy would take care of policy. The Russian czars didn't have a lot of power internally. We've talked about that at great length on this show. National anarchism has a lot to recommend it, and that was, that's one phrase you could use to describe the Slavophiles in 19th century Russia. Bakunin himself said that, I believe it was Kerensky, hated the state even more than he did. So, really, the title should be something like Natural Anarchism or the Old Faith and Rebellion. Because the Old Believer Schism in Russian history, 1666, 67, held up a mirror to the state, especially later on, the Petrian state, and forced the Russian Orthodox people to reconsider what the state is and what it should be. The state is an object of concern for everyone, especially for Orthodoxy. Remember, we talk about politics. Politics has nothing to do with campaigns, elections, and voting. When I talked about politics, I mean issues of justice. So the state, in that sense, has a powerful role in salvation history. But the state, at best, I mean, to be very generous, has a very, very mixed record as far as its relations with the church. It's oppressed the Orthodox community as much as it's helped it. And then Orthodox groups throughout history have fought the state in the name of communal liberty and the faith, like the Cossacks, the Serbian Hajduks, the Montenegrin clans, the Old Believers, all of which have rejected the modern state. More often than not, the state has been an enemy of the nation as well as the Orthodox faith. The state, by definition, is a modern development. Because the state it refers to the interlocking bureaucracies of coercion. It has nothing to do with the medieval concept of justice and natural law. The Germans, especially Hegel, define the state as something along the lines of the Constitution, not the oppressive apparatus. So I'm defining the state in a purely modern sense as a bureaucratic interlocking system of offices. But as I've written many times, the distinction between the nation, the ethnic group, on the one hand, and the state on the other, is substantial. The state is hierarchic, bureaucratic. It thrives on threats and coercion. On the other hand, the ethnos is an organic reality. It's an extended family of persons bound together by a common tradition. One of the original concepts that I have contributed to the study of nationalism is the idea of the commonalities, the traditions that bind a people together are a reaction to suffering. The ethnic tradition exists because there are structures that have come into existence as a reaction to terror, genocide, occupation, colonialism, other dangers and evils. Structures of survival, as I've termed them. So from this derives the moral importance of the ethnic and religious tradition. They are not arbitrary ideas, but they are structures of survival and are developed in order to provide a cohesiveness under a reign of suffering. Unfortunately, this kind of suffering from King Solomon to Peter the First has often come from the Orthodox state itself, and the Orthodox in quote. The Slavophile movement, or the ethno-anarchist movement, was never a rejection of authority or order, but a rejection of the modern state. As I've said, the rejection of the state, defined as a series of bureaucracies interlocking that live parasitically off the accumulated tradition of a people, both religious and ethnic. If the state derives its legitimacy as a defense against internal enemies, Russian historians might do well to ask what protects people from the state, which has been as violent towards its own people as have foreign invaders. The ethnic group is a different story. Now, this is the point of view of the Slavophiles. The ethnos functions as a family does. As the family is a natural institution, which existed prior to the advent of civilization, so is the ethnos, and they function analogously. The state, again, the modern state, represents the worst of civilization, the crystallization of elite authority and tradition into a series of coercive agencies. Tradition, religion, and the ethnos exist not as a motive force for state action, but as excuses for state coercion. Political theory deals with very excuses for state power rather than ideals to be realized in struggle. People forget, even in the best of times, the state was an enemy of the church. In Russia, of course, from Peter the First on, the state has sought to control and dominate Orthodoxy, to destroy its monastic core. I'm referring to the 18th century, of course. 19th century did see substantial improvement. And none of this should be construed to reject the saintly status of many monarchs. But again, monarchy is not the state in the sense that moderns use the term. The old believers, though, again, held up this mirror. The old faith, the Cossack host, alone sought to preserve the medieval, communal, and decentralized tradition represented by the notion of subornost. If the Roman-style monarchy is orthodox, then so is the free commune of Pugachev, or the Krug, the Cossack host. Thinking synodically is a diametric opposite of republicanism, which in reality is the rule of the wealthy under the appearance of universal values. I wrote an entire paper after church one day, years ago. Someone made the comment to me that the Orthodox Synod, the Ecumenical Synod, whatever, show that the church is republican in the sense of, a republican apparatus. The exact opposite is true. Republics are based on wealth after the king has been murdered symbolically. Old Russia was and is represented by the old faith and the Cossack uprisings under Bulavin and Pugachev, Bolotnikov. And it's strange that these uprisings, Pugachev, of course, being the most famous, the programs of these rebellions were identical. A popular monarchy, the free peasant commune, and the old faith. The three ancient pillars of justice. The opposite is the quote-unquote Egyptian rule of technology, centralization, and oligarchy. The three pillars of injustice. This view, you could find it in early medieval Ireland and medieval Serbia. I did a three-part series on medieval Ireland many, many years ago, which is still in my archives. But in all of these places, society was divided up into self-governing communes who elected their clergy and were loyal to local custom. Local monastics offered spiritual guidance, sainthood, not to mention education and social welfare. And the reason that you really can't call the central government in these times a state, though we do it just informally, it was represented by a monarch with a tiny retinue of supporters. His role was purely to defend the faith from outside influences, and he had very little role in the functioning of the mir, or the rod, in any of these places. Emilian Pugachev rose up against Catherine the Great, and he was right to do so. Here is a part of Pugachev's program. By this decree, with sovereign and paternal mercy, we grant to all hitherto in serfdom and subjection to the landowners the right to be faithful subjects of our crown, and we award them villages, the old cross and prayers, beards, liberty, freedom, always to be Cossacks, without recurring levies, soul tax or other money taxes. With possession of the land, the woods, the hay meadows, the fishing grounds, the salt lakes, without payment or rent, and we free all those peasants and other folk hitherto oppressed by the malefactor gentry and bribe takers and judges of the towns from the dues and burdens placed upon them. We wish you the salvation of your souls and a peaceful life here on earth, for we too have tasted and suffered from the malefactor gentry much torture and hardship. Those were gentry in their lands and estates, those opponents of our rule and disturbers of the empire and ruiners of the peasants, seize them, punish them, hang them, treat them in the same way as they, having no Christian feeling, have oppressed you, the peasantry. With the extermination of these enemies, the malefactor gentry, everyone will be able to enjoy a quiet and peaceful life, which will continue forever. And that was written by Pugachev himself in July of 1774. There's a big difference between a bureaucratic monarchy and a popular monarchy. There is no biblical code that permits the slavery of one Israelite by another. Therefore, at the time of the rebellion, landlords were not members of the church, because by that time, serfdom had degenerated badly. There was a brief window, 18th century, where serfdom was absolutely oppressive. And there is no there's no excuse for it. But the quote from Pugachev is an excellent example of a sort of Slavophile Orthodox anarchism. I mean, anarchism in a very, very broad sense. Authority rather than power. And it's a very statement of the Russian idea in these matters. The Enlightenment brought Russia the bureaucratic state, serfdom, landlordism. Subordinate was eliminated from the church hierarchy, which itself, to a great extent, was dominated by the state, the procurator, and the dominant urban hierarchy. To save medieval Russia, especially from the 18th century, rebellion was the only option. I've spoken about the Russian 18th century so much, it's not even, you know, I could do it by rote at this point. Essentially, it was a foreign occupation, with one exception being, of course, the Great Empress Elizabeth. From the Shechem Covenant in the Old Testament to modern ethnic populism, this is the model for Orthodox organizations. The center of the Ukrainian idea, Subornoprovnost, as well as the Cossack Krug. It resurfaces also, you see, in the Chetniks and the Hajduks of Serbia, even the mentality of some Eurasianists. There's nothing new about the nation, the religio-ethnic idea, rejecting the modern state and opting for the rule of the people in the best sense, that is, rule of faith and custom, the crystallized experience of the people. And when I say people, I am not referring to the mass of people. I'm referring to the natural aristocracy of those who have the ability to study deeply into topics, historically and scientifically. There's nothing contradictory in nationalism and populism, properly considered. It rests on the distinction between the state and the nation, with the latter as the origin, and the former, at its worst, as a parasite. And of course, you see this everywhere. In Eastern Europe, as I've mentioned, in Celtic Ireland and in early Anglo-Saxon England, the idea of ethnic and religious belonging certainly predated the modern state by far. In Ireland, of course, the state did not exist, but still the law did under the Brehon Code. How few political scientists have analyzed the notion that law can exist without the state and be fully accepted by all, as was the case in Ireland or England, as well as Serbia, for long periods of time? Well, they can't be seen to be supporting medieval governments, medieval systems, so these are largely ignored. The medieval idea is best represented by the free commune governed by experience, which is custom. The old believers, as well as the Cossacks, who often fought together in the unfortunate 18th century under the pseudo-czars of the era, represented the highest development of what I like to call the paleo-nationalism and ethnic national populism. As the Russian state began to take European forms, like the domination of technology, coercion, and violence, as a regular way of dealing with problems, in a captive and often frightened church, rebellion was imminent. I've gone on ad nauseum about the purging of the church throughout the 18th century. Peter put all of his friends in there. There was not a single legitimate hierarchy in that church by the time Peter died. The notion of a popular czar, a czar who ruled in the medieval form as the icon of piety and defender of the church, rather than as a taskmaster the old faith realized that their life was dying, the life is to Bodernos in the common mind. And you see this during church services, all of our common movements. And they sought the protection of the forest and the bogs, like the Gaelic Irish did, to preserve what was left of the culture. You see this in the Old Believers, you see it in the Irish Nationalists. Old Russia died, or at least was put on ice, with Peter the First. It was revived only to a limited extent under, of course, Tsar Nikolai the Martyr, who unfortunately didn't have time to fulfill his mandate. Well, the 18th century was awful to Russia, the 19th century was much better. Russia became a paragon of justice in the 19th century with a state that was very small. The big bureaucratic regime was a myth. I've said this fact many times before, but the size of the bureaucracy in St. Petersburg was smaller than just the urban bureaucracy of Paris. Order, in terms of social order, exists through tradition and paternal authority. Decisions were taken by the Sobor, were all needed to agree in a course of action. Mutual aid was the center of the old ritualism. It was based on asceticism and the limitation of wants. Bothering with technology and money was viewed as the involving the Orthodox faithful in the world of Satan, who, according to the scriptures, controls the states of the world. When Satan tempted Christ, he would give him all of these kingdoms, which the assumption is that he had possession of those kingdoms to give away. But the old believers never had a modern state. You could also talk about one of the Hasidic Jews or the Amish in America, and yet order is always maintained and a certain degree of prosperity. Open displays of happiness can be seen with them. And despite small numbers, the above groups all have had, the groups I mentioned have had an influence in their respective communal lives far out of proportion to any kind of traditional state power. The Orthodox faith exists not only out of state control, but episcopal control. So law and order also exists outside of state systems, who are usually just a law to themselves. Traditionally, the Orthodox faith, both East and West, bishops were servants rather than masters of the Orthodox Church. That church officially defined as the entire body of faithful, struggling to live the monastic life dependent on their surroundings. The Skete and the Hermitage were the spiritual center of the society. And specifically in Ireland, the bishop was under the authority of the abbot and existed really pretty much to ordain priests. There is certainly nothing sacred or traditional about bishops as dominating parishes and monastics, and certainly nothing sacred about the centralized state, something explicitly condemned in the Law of Moses. There's an old believer tract that I translated, one of my early books, Sobornosti, my book on the Middle Ages. I'm sorry, on the Russian Middle Ages or on the Old Believers. And I quoted this for that book, and it was anonymous, and it says this: the satanic nexus with the state is also described or implied in Daniel 10:13, Ezekiel 28, and Revelation 17. In these passages, Satan is called the Prince of Kingdom of Persia and the King of Tyre. Plus, the kings of the earth are described as having intimate and illicit relationship with Satan by way of his scarlet beast and the woman who is carried by it. So once again, we find a direct link between Satan and the earthly rulers that God ordains. The devil certainly controlled these kings, assuming that they were historical figures. Perhaps he even possessed them. Hence, we have more evidence to suggest that the state may credibly be considered part of the kingdom of Satan and only ordained by God in the sense the devil himself is ordained by God to fulfill his purposes and to glorify him. The scriptures indicate that the state is often a minister of judgment ordained by God. Like, for example, in Isaiah chapter 3 is probably the best example. To varying degrees, in each judgment situation, the state becomes the rod of God's anger and the staff of his indignation, Isaiah 10. It receives a charge from God to punish the people who are objects of his terrestrial wrath. The Bible says the Lord himself brings calamity on people. Isaiah 45. The state is often a judgment against the people over which it rules, particularly outside of the theocracy of Judah, although God has also used the state to judge foreigners during Old Testament theocratic kingdoms. Yet the state that serve God in this way are often at least as wicked as the one that they judge, showing that not all of God's ordained servants are upright in character. Romans 13:4. Casting aside popular myths to the contrary, the state's evil nature and bad character are realities to be expected. So in this passage, the state is almost inherently a satanic instrument, and he makes reference to governments in the Old Testament and elsewhere being a curse, something that is used for punishment. Remember, we're talking about power, not necessarily authority. The church is governed not by synods, really, but by tradition and former examples of holiness. There's no synodal decision that could ever be considered valid that hadn't already existed in the hearts of the simple people. So one's on solid ground in condemning the patriarch Nikon, although not his followers, because given the size of the rebellion against his reforms, the reforms were merely top-down commands and were not part of the natural development of the Orthodox faith incarnated in the people via the Holy Spirit. At the same time, society is also so governed as a family through patriarchal authority that seeks to rule by example and exhortation rather than violence. As Solomon took the reins in Israel, Solomon is one of the great, and a question I've always had, and I've never gotten a straight answer here, is why King Solomon is depicted in a halo. He died a heretic. He died an unrepentant heretic of the worst sort. Anyway, as Solomon takes the reins of Israel, he immediately uses his power to import foreign gods. He multiplied wives, engaged international alliances that also serve as examples of illegitimate ecumenism. It might be noted that those items above, or they're all pretty much the same, making alliances with pagan states meant taking some of their women as wives. This is how some of these things were adjudicated. So these women coming to Israel were permitted to take their own gods to the temple. Solomon had to, if these treaties are going to work. Solomon was expected to give at least some veneration to these pagan entities. So Solomon died in heresy, and the ultimate example of a heretical and illegitimate king, regardless of his talents elsewhere. Peter the Great in Russia, upon taking power, confirms all the fears of the anti-Nikon resistance. Old Russia manifests in the old believers. Something else I've gone on and on about is Peter the Great. He brought forth extreme methods of tax collection, the first to engage in forced labor projects, and a massive assault on the church. The difference between Peter and the USSR is technology. Peter didn't have the bureaucracy that the Soviets had. Tens of thousands died in Peter's forced labor camps in order to build his new capital and other industrial projects throughout the country. Then he tied serfdom to industrialization, which was demonic. Serfdom can be justified under many circumstances, but when you take these people and put them in the factory, that's a different story. Now, serfdom in the 18th century was wrong, but certainly not as bad as the modern commentators claim. Sorry, my cat Marcel just fell off the printer. Anyway, on the other hand, the rule of Mammon is made clear when Peter the First decided to engage in the forcible enslavement of people. There we go. That was one of my. That was not Stanley. That was Black Cat Marcel. I knew it was going to happen. I'm watching him. He's on the printer. He knocked everything over. And so, Pugachev was Catherine's rebellion. Rosine was Peter's. And one of the things that caused the revolt against Peter was the enslavement of peasants and then assigning them to factories. But those uprisings, the three really big ones in imperial history, that is the uprisings of Rosin, Bulavin, and Pugachev, were aimed at restoring what we might term an ethno-anarchist model of life, although usually in inarticulate ways. One element revolved around the organic nature of the old faith, as opposed to the purely hierarchic model of Nikonian Orthodoxy. Another centered around the ethnic commune and the Russian tradition over the cosmopolitan coercion of Peter, Anne 1 and 2, and Catherine 1 and 2. It centered around rural communalism and decentralization, rather than the urban centralization of capital and the foreign heterodox control. It stood for happiness over utility. It stood for Russia over the West. When Bulavin and Pugachev were defeated, the Cossack autonomy was eliminated, and the old faith butchered with even greater ferocity. Russia became a top-down, coercive monarchy, rather than the new Israel. Petersburg became pagan, rather than Christian, and power was pursued for the sake of wealth and control, and the new, often non-Russian service class tormented their peasants to afford the latest European fads, like new carriages, and their developing roulette addiction that Dostoevsky used to make fun of. Romantic nationalism, in the ethno-communal sense, stands for the organic over the artificial. If this is true, then the abstract individual and untrammeled desires are the most modern and fraudulent of all. What is natural, what exists prior to civilization, is the family, the ethnos, and the proper worship of God in spirit and truth. Civilization does not need to exist for all those things to function. Culture does. God is revealed in the symbols of nature, but obscured in modern times, where nature is merely raw material. The veneration of the ever-perishing natural world is itself a product of the Enlightenment. One way to understand culture is the humanization of nature, bringing it into the symbolic world of belonging. You know, trees aren't just trees, but they're symbols of a higher reality. And you see this in the Russian veneration of the birch, or the Celtic veneration of the oak. Trees have intensely deep symbolic identities and understandings. Natural objects become sacramental objects in the old faith. They become markers of identity. As the Cossack sees the steppe, the Montenegrin militiaman sees the mountains and crags. Nature itself becomes part of the language of life. Modernity sees it as either raw material to be exploited or the suburban tree-hugging sentimentality of fashionable environmentalism. I've taken flack over the years for quoting Rousseau and Spinoza, but less so for Johann Herder. But Herder and Rousseau have a few things in common. They show man living in accordance with nature and the tradition that such interaction helps to create. Locke sees rationality and utility over organic connection. Without the connection of community to nature and to custom, there's certainly no contradiction there, alienation, ill health, and mental illness result. These are the results not of biological processes, but of alienation, the mask that modern civilization forces people to wear, given their various social roles. They are an exploited subject people dominated by the whims of fashion and media control, from which their identity, clothing, and even their language derives. The ultimate reality of natural and organic living is the sobor, the peasant commune, the love of tradition. State power exists not to guard tradition, but to manipulate it in the interest of power and utility. James Billington, The Icon and the Axe, one of the first books I read on Russian history many years ago, says this: the defenders of the Muscovite ideal of an organic religious civilization were being confronted in their own land with a sovereign secular state similar to those of Western Europe. The year 1667 accelerated this trend through the formal transfer of Kiev from long years of Polish overlordship to Muscovite control and the promulgation of new decrees ensuring national control over all foreign trade. The process of freeing autocratic authority from any effective restraint by local or conciliar bodies had already been accomplished in the early years of Alexis' reign by the crushing of town revolts and the Abolition of the Zemensky Sobota. It's on page 145. It was a Dutchman who actually was living a contemporary in the Tsar Alexis era. And he's quoted in Averitz's book, Russian Rebels, that commoners petitioned the Tsar. And he says, concerning the intolerable great taxes and contributions, whereby they were overburdened for some years, so with their wives and children they were thereby ruined, besides which the great oppressions which the boyars did daily lay upon them, and that they were not able to hold out much longer. They desired rather with their wives and children to undergo a present death than to suffer any longer in such transcendent oppression. Paul Averitz, the same author, in Russian Rebels, he says this concerning Bulavin in the Old Belief. They saw the deeds of Antichrist not only in Peter's irreverent mockery of religious worship, but also in the ruthless accumulation of power at the expense of the people. For them, the centralized state was an artificial body forcibly grafted on Russian society, an alien growth weighing heavily upon the poor and responsible for their suffering. The rebels were particularly numerous among the Cossacks and the Streltsy, the semi-autonomous groups which, threatened with the loss of their traditional privileges and status, expressed their social grievances in religious dissent. The Old Belief, paradoxically, was a deeply conservative movement that simultaneously became a restless and even revolutionary force in Russian life. And in the book Religious Revolt in the 16th Century, Nicholas Lupinin says the following. What the Council of 1682 actually did was to structure a system of repression against the Old Believers. It was the first time in Russian history, as Kardashev notes, that the spirit of Western Inquisition had been manifested over half a century of continuous foreign influences and helped to foment the notion of counteracting any opposition. Now, the Old Belief, the Cossack Krug, the medieval commune, it rests on three ideas. The popular monarchy, the free commune, and the ancient faith. As I said before, each exists for the other, and none can exist without the other. There's no right action outside of right belief, and all right action depend on correct ideas of God and his relationship to man. The monarch, we talk about a popular monarchy. What are we talking about? The popular monarch is an icon of the Trinity. His job is to defend the Orthodox people from heretics and schismatics, from within and without. As God says to Moses concerning political virtue, thou shalt not receive the voice of a lie, neither thou shalt bear false witness to the wicked. Thou shalt not follow the multitude to do evil, neither thou shalt yield in judgment to the majority opinion that stray from the truth. Again in chapter 18, and this is in Ezekiel. This is God speaking. This is 3 Kings, chapter 14. Be thou to the people in those things that pertain to God, to bring their words to him, and show the people the ceremonies and manner of worship, and the right way to walk in God, and the work that they shall do, and to provide for all the people able men, such as fear God, in whom there is truth, and that hate avarice, and appoint them rulers over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. As for the kings who overstep their bounds, begin to worship their own power. God says to Jeroboam, for as much as I exalted thee among the people that made thee prince over Israel, and rent the kingdom away from David and gave it to thee, and as thou hast not been my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed them with his whole heart, but thou hast done evil in my sight, and has made strange gods to provoke my anger. That's 3 Kings 14. The monarchy is a symbol of God's power and the unity of the law. In old Russia, he did not dominate. The Orthodox life doesn't know that kind of institution, but acts in what you might call a mystic capacity rather than a bureaucratic one. He's a living icon rather than a politician. He's a charismatic personality rather than a tax collector. His job is to defend the faith and oversee the commune. Ecclesiasticus writes, have they made thee ruler? Be not lifted up. Be among them as one of them. In other words, this is a purely popular institution. You're no different than anybody else. Legally speaking. Remember, I refer to the people. You have to be very careful in using that phrase. People talk about that all the time. They say the people, the citizens, the population. No, these are the politically active. These are those who have the ability and knowledge and honesty to pursue this stuff at great length. That's how the American Founding Fathers defined the people. That natural aristocracy who had the wherewithal to understand these things, Roman and Greek history, etc. So I'm not referring to the mass, I'm referring to the people. But the free peasant commune was always at the forefront of the old believers and the rebellions against bureaucracy under Boulavin and Razin. The free commune, as is traditional, elected its leaders and law enforcers and should be represented in the capacity of heads of household, for the economy is based on the natural institution of the extended family, of which both the parish, commune, ethnos, and labor association is a natural outgrowth. This is largely the case in medieval Serbia, Ireland, and the Cossack Coast, as I've said before. And it remains part of their nationalist heritage even today. Kingship and commune are based on law, which itself is based on custom, ethnic tradition, and the canon laws of the church, all of which are, in turn, based on experience, survival, and suffering. The commune, or the labor association, should exist in coordination with the local parish and monastery for instruction and social welfare measures, forming a web of institutions that serve both for the worship of God and for the fulfilling of natural needs. This was St. Andrew the New Martyr, Andrew of Ufa, had this as his Valentine Sintiski too. New martyrs who saw the parish as a center of life and in connection with the commune and the artel or the industrial union. Rousseau, who I know is a dangerous person, quote, did have quite a bit to say on this. Rousseau says this: "I conceive that there are two kinds of inequality amongst the human species. One which I call natural or physical, because it is established by nature, and consists in a difference of age, health, bodily strength, and the qualities of the mind or of the soul. And another, which may be called moral or political inequality, because it depends on a kind of convention, and is established, or at least authorized, by the consent of men. This latter consists in the different privileges which some men enjoy to the prejudice of others, such as that of being more rich, more honored, more powerful, or even in a position to exact obedience." Now, Rousseau connects it to the passions. He says, "It must in the first place be allowed that, the more violent the passions are, the more are laws necessary to keep them under restraint. But setting aside the inadequacy of laws to effect this purpose, which is evident from the crimes and disorders to which these passions daily give rise among us, we should do well to inquire if these evils did not spring up with the laws themselves. For in this case, even if the laws were capable of repressing such evils, it is the least that could be expected from them, that they should check a mischief which would not have arisen without them." In other words, modernity is the cause of its own problems. But all of this, I don't quote Rousseau very often, but all of this has to be based on the ancient Orthodox faith, for that which is foreign to it is a result of egocentric philosophizing and theorizing. Heresy exists due to the ego, as almost all the fathers have stated. God made it very clear to Moses that there was an immediate unity between justice and truth, between believing rightly and thus behaving rightly. Wants are not needs. As the capitalist economy is drowning in debt, and more people reject the system of wants must be transformed into a system of needs. As capitalism functions by provoking these wants into needs, wants that didn't even exist yesterday, but are demanded today, as Ecclesiasticus says, quote, "Watching for riches consumes the flesh, and the thought thereof drives away sleep. He that loves gold shall not be justified, and he that follows after corruption shall not be filled with it." End quote. There's no love of gold without corruption. It's one and the same thing. The prophet Jeremiah says, If thou wilt return, O Israel, says Jehovah, if thou wilt return unto me, and if thou wilt put away thine abominations out of my sight, thou shalt not be removed. And you'll swear, as Jehovah lives, in truth and justice and righteousness, and the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory. And that's in that's chapter 4. And again in chapter 7. For if ye thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if ye thoroughly execute justice between a man and his neighbor, if ye oppress not the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods, your own heart, then I will cause you to dwell in this place, in the land I gave to your fathers, from of old, even forevermore. And then he says, hear ye the word which Jehovah speaks unto you, O house of Israel. Thus says Jehovah, learn not the way of the nations, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the nations are dismayed at them. The concept of the synod and subordinates, things like economic production, worship, and ethnic belonging all belong to the social order. There's a connection of one man to another and one family to another as being one in the old faith. All is to be decided by the synodal system. And again, this is Andrew Wolfe, who I've talked about at great length, St. Valentine too, all to be decided by the synodal system, from agricultural duties to the ruling of local parishes or dioceses. Nothing should be done by any episcopal authority, though, that's not already part of the local parish and monastic tradition. But that vision in the thought of the Sobor is applicable in the economic realm, as the family, as the ethnos. But these concepts are beyond and completely foreign the modern bureaucratic state, to the modern bureaucratic state. Rousseau is a surprising ally here. The concept of the synod is not foreign to him, even though he wasn't a Christian. It's striking to the extent that the general will is similar to the idea of the synod. He says, there is often a great deal of difference between the will of all and the general will. The latter considers only the common interest, while the former takes private interests into account and is no more than a sum of particular wills. But take away from these same wills the pluses and minuses that cancel one another, and the general will remains as a sum of differences. That aspect is often ignored in our views of Rousseau. The general will is not simply a collection of private interests. Unfortunately, the American Constitution has that as an assumption. But Rousseau says, the first and most important deduction from the principles we have so far laid down is that the general will alone can direct the state according to the object for which it is instituted, for the common good. For if the clashing of particular interests made the establishment of societies necessary, the agreement of these very interests made it possible. The common element in all of these different interests is what forms the social tie. And were there no point of agreement between them all, no society could exist. It is solely on the basis of this common interest that every society should be governed. I hold that sovereignty, being nothing less than the exercise of the general will, can never be alienated, and that the sovereign, who is no less than a collective being, cannot be represented except by himself. The power, indeed, may be transmitted, but not the will. That's a very simple but powerful way to describe the synodia. Not democracy or republicanism, but the concept of subordinates and the synod. Rousseau says concerning what a law is, but when the whole people decrees for the whole people, it is considering only itself. And if a relation is then formed, it is between two aspects of the entire object, without there being any division of the whole. In that case, the matter about which this decree is made is, like the decreeing will, general. That act is what I call a law. So, now when you transfer this to the Orthodox Synod, it is the whole people, monks, clergy, bishops, laity, who are charged with ratifying canons and comparing them with established experience, which is another word for tradition. Again, this is synodal, not a republican or a democratic point of view. Republicanism, democracy, deal with the collection of individual wills, and those individual wills manipulated by those who have the power to substitute appearance for reality. That's the difference. The general will in Rousseau is extremely subtle. It is not a collection of private interests. Back to the Old Testament, God commanded to Moses that all the first fruits of one's labor be dedicated to God. In other words, all labor, whether in the field or factory, is Eucharistic. It partakes of grace so long as it is done within the order of the synod. All social relations are brought under the concept of subordinates, in the sense that all derive from the natural extended family structure. For the corporate worship of God is familial in the parish organism and is analogously related to the monastic synodia, as well as the council of the parish and the council of the diocese. As for the producers and farmers' associations, too, they all partake of the synodal structure. And even Moses, in Numbers 2, says, "All the children of Israel shall camp with their troops, ensigns, and standards, and the houses of their kindreds round about the tabernacle." The Old Testament is a wealth of inspired information about politics. And the surprising thing is that how these two poles, justice and injustice, are identical over the years, or actually similar over the years. So for the poor, Moses says, "If thy brother be constrained by poverty, sell himself to thee, he shall work with thee until the year of the Jubilee, and afterwards he shall go out with his kindred and return to them in their possessions. For they are my servants, and I brought them out of the land of Egypt. Let them not be sold." This is the economy of the Orthodox Church. Debts may not be accumulated for more than 7 years in the Old Testament, as all the extended families of Israel are the same, are equal. No one has a right to accumulate riches on the backs of others. Serfdom is condemned so long as it's more than 7 years, where according to God all debts and profits are to be returned to their original owners, land bought via speculation is to be returned, and any serf is to be freed. The 7-year jubilee is something almost forgotten. You see it in Leviticus, you see it in Numbers. It's forgotten by almost everybody. That was a social order in ancient Israel. In other words, rebellions of people like Pukhatev had the law of Moses on its side. The concept of the Jubilee, which was central to the Israelite economics, was forgotten even by fellow Israelites at the time, and they were oppressed. The Israelite state, almost overwhelmingly, was one of sin and oppression, with a few exceptions. Poverty is as unavoidable as profits, but the law makes it clear that this is temporary, and everything will be returned to the original family synodia after 6 years, 7 years. As a result, no aristocracy or oligarchy could ever be formed according to law. And this is nearly identical to the Brehon laws of ancient Ireland, where land was held by the tribal unit, including the parish and monastery. After a certain period of time, roughly 6 years, a client of a lord can be let go, taking the usufruct of his labors, that is to say, not owning the land, but being able to take what you do with it. And the ancient Irish understanding is very similar to the Old Testament concept of economics. Under the law of Moses, in Leviticus, there's to be little work done every seventh year, not just every seventh day. As a land, as well as neighboring families, need rest. This is a time for prayer, service to the poor and the ethnic community. Whatever grows in the fields should be donated to the poor, and should anything be left over, left in the fields since the last harvest. Every 50th year, all economic relations are then reset in an even more extreme way. Each family again starts out with what was theirs at the very beginning. Exploitation, by state or by private actors, it's explicitly rejected by the Old Testament. All that is sold can be redeemed. Leviticus chapter 25 is important. Leviticus verse 29 is extremely important. To the remnant of Israel, the true Orthodox, in order to live proper lives, must form these synodia. We pool resources to the extent each family can allow and organize ourselves into separate communities against the corrupt Egyptian society around us. The home should be a monastery, as St. Nikolai Vemilovich writes, tightly connected with the agricultural commune or labor association, seeking spiritual assistance as well as occasional financial assistance from the local monastery. That is the natural economy, the social life based on the cell of the extended family, and extending itself perfectly into labor legislation, parish, diocese, under an elected synod, with elections based on holiness and truthfulness. Media, entertainment, the same. Relieving families from depending on the corrupt and oligarchic media system of the regime. But these are ideals, of course. You apply this to Putin's Russia, for example. The state does have an important role. Far from ideal, the Russian state under Putin is important to destroy the power of the Western-supported oligarchical and American-Israeli-based mafia. Decentralization doesn't make much sense if it will just merely give power back to organized crime groups. So such power, preferably led by a popular militia, is needed to cleanse Russia from its criminal element. Once that's done, and a popular and local Cossack militia is created, decentralization and re-ruralization can take place in a context of security. So the Russian state is necessary to cleanse Russia from elements that the system of power in the West has helped create. Any movement for decentralization and sustainable living needs to go through phases, with the cleansing phase, the first, of course. And what I've tried to do here is to give some theoretical foundation for the restructuring of Orthodox society. Capitalism is showing tremendous structural weakness long before COVID. Shocks to the system may well bring it to the end. So there has to be a plan of sorts. As things get bad, so Orthodox people can live rational and holy lives outside of the mainstream. Social nationalism stands for the building of alternative subcultural community that slowly but surely developed in such a way that the state is rendered irrelevant. It stands for statelessness, but also for community, and community governed by tradition and canon law, which is merely a crystallization of tradition and experience of Orthodox generations throughout history. But these are hardly revolutionary. There's nothing new about them. This is how civilization functioned most of the time. But those who rebelled against the Enlightenment monarchs, so-called Enlightened absolutists, Razin, the Cossacks, and later on, the High Dukes of Serbia, they were reaching to reestablish something that existed before. In medieval Ireland, Serbia, within the Cossack hosts, the High Dukes, the Old Believer communities, this social nationalist model had been in existence for centuries. Given the size of the state today, it may even be called an ethno-anarchist model. So reestablishing it, based on the law of the Old Testament, is necessary for the creation of rational structures in an irrational world. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.